Now, the world of an orchestral composer that seems so rarefied to me, it's such a other world. I wonder, what was the process for you to become a composer?
I'm a cellist. I'm a classical cello player. Mm-hmm. I did my undergraduate degree in cello performance. Mm-hmm. And I did a minor elective in composition. I was always attracted to writing music for film. And I have done some film. Mm-hmm. But my journey towards being an orchestral composer has been from playing inside an orchestra and then on one strand, and then on the second strand is my composing career started as a composer for the theatre. Mm-hmm. In the mid-90s, I auditioned to play a role in Louis Naura's play Cossi, about mm-hmm. a bunch of lunatics in an asylum putting on Mozart's opera Così fan tutti.
Oh, yes.
Anyway, that was for Black Swan Theatre, and I started composing for Black Swan for many years and had no desire, really, to write to be a classical composer. Mm. But little by little, the ephemeral nature of writing for theatre, like, is both its great strength, but it also held a little bit of sadness, because mm-hmm. once a theatre production is gone, then there is no record of it.
Yeah.
It's only in people's memories. Mm. And the idea of having something which could be interpreted by someone on the other side of the globe without me there,
yeah,
is enticing. So some opportunities came up through the West Australian Symphony Orchestra. And I started writing for a small version of them, their Education Chamber Orchestra, a little 15-piece orchestra, doing education shows. So that's kind of coming at it from a theatrical bent. And then little by little, they both encouraged me but commissioned me for a number of works. I wrote a number of works for the West Australian Youth Orchestra and for youth orchestras around the country. And then I became the West Australian Symphony Orchestra's composer in residence.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a period of 2 years where I really got deep inside the idea of writing for an orchestra.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of on-the-job training. Although you have clearly a strong background, you still obviously got a lot of your learning from actually doing it.
Yes, look, I started a master's many years ago and never completed it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not philosophically against further study on any level. Mm. I really love it, actually.
Mm.
And would love to have had the time to have completed it, or a PhD, or any further study beyond my bachelor degree.
Mm.
But I love the fact that I've been able to earn money and make a living during the course of learning my craft.
Yeah, absolutely. Great for anybody.
Yeah.
Very good. And do you feel like you've had to make sacrifices? And once again, I think about people, serious classical musicians who have to practice hours a day, and there's so much work going behind making something look simple and easy.
Mm.
If you look back and think about your childhood, you know, I have images of people stuck inside studying while their friends are outside playing, things like that.
Certainly, in terms of practice, while you're a teenager and while at university, but truth be known, I've worked harder at being a composer than I ever worked at practicing my instruments.
Mm.
I gave up the learning the piano properly at age 12, because mm-hmm. the cello kind of took over. But I used to busk every day. Mm-hmm. Just used to get music out of the music library in Western Australia and just learn. That's how I learned all of the music that I play on the piano. I essentially taught myself
mm-hmm.
these various other styles, which have stood me in good stead for my cabaret work and my theatre work. But I would never deign to play other people's classical music on the piano. Okay. I've got a very limited repertoire there. So to go to your question, I love playing music. And it's intrinsically connected to my social life. So I don't feel like I've missed out on anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I do work hard at composing, and sometimes I feel, as I've grown to maturity, that I am creatively, I would like to share a space. So why I like working in theatre and why working as a classical composer is tricky is because working as a classical composer, you're in a small isolated place. You're there's you and a piece of manuscript paper.
Yeah.
For me, creatively, I find having people to bounce off instantaneously is very is very useful.
Got it. Yeah. Give us a kind of overview of the process. How does it begin from the brief? I'm curious to know how long it might take you to compose a 5-minute work and what's involved in the process.
So, little by little, I have a child at home, an 18-month-old daughter, and I find the act of writing a 5-minute piece or a 20-minute piece takes about the same amount of time, actually. Perhaps there's a little bit more 3/4 of the way through the process. Actually getting that the number of notes onto a page takes longer, but the conception of the piece is a similar duration. Mm-hmm. What is the relationship between the rest of the world and this piece of abstract music?
Mm-hmm.
And for me to find that connection, and oftentimes that's a narrative connection. Occasionally it's a visual connection, or a historical connection. But it's having some relationship between the outside world, the real world, and this inner world, which is so beautifully described by music.
Mm-hmm.
What do those notes, which intrinsically mean nothing, how do you give them meaning, or what are you trying to say with a series of notes that have been arranged in a certain order?
Very good, yeah. I'd like to come back to that in a little while. But I'm also just interested in the practicalities of it too. Mm. You know, for example, do you compose on the computer, or are you like a traditional... Do they still do that? People sit there with a manuscript, paper and pen.
So, yes, I use a computer to write, but I find that my music turns out better when I sit at a piano and with a piece of manuscript paper and find worlds and sounds and ideas from inside the playing experience.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly in terms of pacing a piece, I'll write it at a piano in terms of it having an ebb and a flow. I certainly won't get all the notes because I'm not that good enough of a pianist, but I'll get the sense of energy and ebb and flow.
Mm-hmm.
So that I go, okay, something like that to make a 5-minute piece. Mm-hmm. It's going to need to build and have tension and then come back into something small. So I can get very much a sketch at a piano with manuscript and have a rough, perhaps the harmonic shape of it. Mm-hmm. I can do. And then once I get into detail, into orchestration and into... perhaps the finer parts of form of a piece, I'll be inside a computer.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Very good. But certainly there's something about the conception where you see an entire piece on a manuscript,
mm-hmm.
that you're the way the human brain, or my brain works anyway, is you're making connections that might not otherwise be there when you've only got 6 or 7 bars on a computer screen visible to you, and you can get too stuck in the minutiae and not enough in the
macro. Lose the bigger picture, got it. And how well, I mean, you know, I guess if you're talking about sketching on the piano, the colouring in is the orchestration, the instrumentation, how well do you need to know all those different instruments that you're writing for?
As I said earlier, I grew up playing in orchestras, so certainly youth orchestras as a teenager, but once I knew that I was heading towards being a composer through my 20s, I used to actively listen in an orchestra from playing at the back of the cello section. And just when there were certain moments, I distinctly remember playing Daphnis and Chloe, the Ravel ballet, and playing the concert suite of it, and just this extraordinary moment where it's just like, how did he get that sound? It's when, and for me, great orchestration is when you cease to hear individual instruments and all you hear is a mass. And so that, because an orchestra is greater than the sum of its parts in those moments.
Yeah.
And how do you blend those into it so it becomes a single cohesive whole and not a series of individual things?
Yeah.
And that's generally my aesthetic inside an orchestra. So I actively listened inside there and then went away and studied those scores,
mm-hmm.
To see how those great orchestrators... Stravinsky, Ravel, generally 20th century, but mm-hmm. but on the conservative side of 20th century music. Not the Brian Ferneyhoes and the Boulezes and the Stockhausens.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they're intrinsically great orchestrators. I think the great advances in orchestration happened in the first half of the 20th century.
And so
I find emulating them or learning from them is really rewarding.
Mm. Got it. And what's it like, you've been nutting something out for however long it takes, and finally it's complete and it's played by the orchestra for the first time? How does it feel?
So now I'm able, through having done a dozen pieces perhaps for orchestra, I'm less nervous now.
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning, it was the single most terrifying thing that can ever happen.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps because programs are better now and you get a closer idea of mm-hmm. what it's going to be like. I always tell my composition students to not rely too much on their software, be it Sibelius or Finale, to say that's what it's actually going to sound like. But
yeah.
you can generally get a sense of how the orchestra will sound. Initially, it was because I've been a musician on the other side of the equation, I deeply value the time and investment that every one of those people has put into learning their instrument, and then the great honour there is of having half an hour of their time. So placing dots in front of them, and then they will play it.
Mm.
And it's an extraordinary luxury, actually, to be in a position to actually get given that time.
Mm.
So philosophically, I'm always writing for musicians and through the musician's enjoyment for an audience. I'm not writing directly for an audience ever. So I'm very much philosophically, it's not that I won't ask a musician to write something different, to play something difficult, but I will, ask them to play something difficult with the full knowledge that it's difficult, not through a lack of an awareness of what I'm doing. So I say, this is very high on your instrument, I'm aware of that, but it's for this reason, this reason, this reason. My fear at the beginning of my life as a composer was I didn't know necessarily what was difficult for various instruments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and also, you just don't know yourself as a human, you know, when you're 23 years old and you're asking 40-year-old musicians to play it. Like, what the hell do you have to say to them?
Yeah.
You don't. So you're just... my life in working in the other performing arts has helped my relationship with classical musicians.
Mm-hmm.
In my life as a composer for theatre and for dance, you become a fox. You become a person who knows a lot about knows a little bit about a lot of things, rather than the danger which you can get, which is becoming too much of a hedgehog,
mm-hmm.
which is that idea of the academic who knows an extraordinary amount about very little, about a very small part of the panoply of human knowledge. So I enjoy knowing. I would love to know a lot about a lot of things, but my brain's not big enough.
Mm.
And certainly in terms of speaking with classical musicians, I love coming at it from a theatrical background, so that everyone just wants to know where they fit in a particular work or in a particular piece or what's required of them, and to be able to reassure them of their role above and beyond play that G sharp in tune, but so that they can have a specific extra musical idea. If I can describe that extra musical idea within their score or directly person to person, then for me that's when you start to get a personal connection with the music and the music starts to sing.
Very good, very good. And so the different areas that you work in, theatre, dance, film, pure orchestral music, what are the differences in how you prepare things for those different genres?
A lot of it's about timelines. So a theatre show, I'll start on the first day of rehearsal, will have no idea about what I'm going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And over the course of the 5 weeks of rehearsal, I'll write a score. There's almost no use until you know who you're working with and how you're working. You can have some vague ideas about the world that you might inhabit, what instruments you might want to play, what cast members might, instruments they might bring, and what skills they might bring that you can utilise within a score. So a theatre show, there is no score before day one of rehearsal, and over those weeks you
mm-hmm.
play it. With a dance score, you need to be more prepared and have some things to start with on day one, so that they can start to choreograph to music and then just stay ahead. Thankfully, choreographing a dance work is a very slow process, so generally I can stay 2 weeks ahead of mm-hmm. where they're at, and the choreographer can generate the material at the same speed that I can write it. And with pure orchestral music, it's this really very odd kind of experience of writing something completely in isolation and then providing a finished product.
Mm-hmm.
And I love being more involved in the rehearsal at that point. So you just need, their time is very valuable, but you need to be very much on the top of your game in that rehearsal so that you can answer questions which can be very small. Is this a staccato or a tenuto on this note? Is this scale involving an E-flat or not? Or the macro questions generally from a conductor saying, are we getting a sense of the form in how we're playing it?
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of like the intensity of that. It took me a long time when I started working in theatre to understand the spaciousness of that rehearsal period. Drove me insane
because
I was used to the intensity of these 2.5 hour, don't talk, just play, you know, and the intensity of all of that time.
Mm-hmm.
They're very different worlds, and I like how they inform each other.
Very good, very good. With all this diversity of work that you do and the kind of non-specialisation that you're talking about, do you think that you've still been able to develop your own style? Do you have a distinctive Ian Grandage style?
It's hard for me to say. I'm aware that there's certain sounds that I return to. I think that arrives. I think that's in a constant state of arriving, and as each of us as humans continues to aspire towards getting closer to who we imagine we might be.
Mm-hmm.
My life as a composer is similarly a process of finding my true voice. I really enjoy writing to commission, to make a work as bespoke as possible. So if I'm writing for a community choir, I'm going to write very differently than if I'm writing for a bunch of highly trained vocal soloists. If it's a work for the opening of a festival, then I'm not going to write something that's deeply introspective and alienating for an audience. I'll write something that's hopefully euphoric and is able to be enjoyed at first listening. I enjoy writing things that are more difficult listening when the commission is appropriate for that. All of those things tend to pull in different directions in terms of you going, no, I'm not an iconoclast on any level. But there are undoubtedly bits where you go, that's Ian Grandage. There's certain sounds which you'd be able to recognise.
Mm-hmm.
But it's those questions I find hard to answer because they're almost for other people to go, that's
right.
That's you.
How many people could I be around you at any time?
Yeah.
So recently, of course, you composed a piece for the Hush Music Foundation for their latest collection. It was a wonderful collection. I love the whole thing. Firstly, maybe you could just give us a little bit of an explanation about the Hush project.
Yeah. The Hush project was started by this wonderful doctor, Kath Croc, at the Royal Melbourne Children's Hospital. She works as an anaesthetist and was aware of various ways that children cope in what can be a very high-stress environment, and was looking at a multitude of ways of softening that environment and that experience for children so that it became less frightening and more familiar. And one of the ways that she and Paul Grabowski, the great Australian musician and piano player and composer, decided to approach this was by having bespoke music written for these environments. They've done 12 CDs before this one, in generally chamber or solo performers, and that's just been about the means and the people who they've come in contact with. And then for this one, the Tasmanian Symphony Orchestra and Benjamin Northey, as conductor, have come on board. This CD is a step up for the Hush Foundation because they've commissioned these works rather than them being extant works donated to the foundation. So to be included on that list of a dozen Australian composers is a great honour, actually, because many of those are have been formative in my compositional world.
Yeah, for sure. There's some of them. Most of the great names in Australian composers, I think. Yeah. It's a fantastic collection. So a unique brief, no doubt. Your piece, I really loved your piece called Suspended. Just listening to it was wonderful. But then I read the liner notes, the brief liner notes, where you gave a little explanation. Yeah. And that, to me, added a whole beautiful dimension to the experience of listening to it. So I'm just kind of curious to see whether you can tell us a little bit more about how you came about what you decided to write.
Yeah. So Kath, as she did with all of the composers, invited each of us to come in and watch her work. Not so much her work, but see what this environment was at the Royal Children's Hospital. I went in there and I was amazed at the care and generosity and warm-heartedness that everyone in her team had for these patients who were coming through. So I was struck by the idea of this group of medics as a family. And they are a family, but every one of these children who comes into the hospital has their own family. And so in these sort of concentric, ever decreasing circles, there's a child in the centre and their family around them, and around them there's this medical team. All buffering this child to the best of their ability while they go through these tough times. In speaking to each of the team, they were very conscious of it not being too, of there being no sense of the music being maudlin, of there being no sense of the music being being at all plaintive. They needed it to be affirmative. Music is intrinsically powerful as a way of communicating with people's psyche, and I think they're aware that they're on dangerous grounds. But as soon as you have an orchestra and the way that people can respond to orchestras, the work ended up coming out more beautiful than I expected. And so I was slightly fearful as I was writing it, going, is this getting too much into, is this going to be too, is it too much in that, could it release any sorrow, I suppose, because it fears on the side of beauty rather than on the side of austerity.
Mm-hmm.
But the way people have responded to it has been incredibly warm. The story behind it is that there's a child, I've personified it to a single family, a child who is played by the clarinet in the work, and that child's family is the strings. The child is very free and has lots of, it plays a lot compared to the sort of solid support of the strings. little by little, the brass, who are the medics, get introduced into the work, led by the trumpet, who is Kath. And then as the procedure and the work continue, the child is anaesthetized, and so the clarinet is silenced. The family are out of the room, so they're also silenced. And in the centre of the work, you're just in the care of this brass chorale. And then the clarinet and the strings all return as the child returns from anaesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just it's that narrative helped me kind of give us an arc as we go through these repeated procedures that these kids in the cancer ward go through. I always wanted there to be it's a circular process, and it's one that that circularity is intrinsically hopeful. We've started in a place and we'll get back to that place.
Mm-hmm.
We've started in health and we go through a dark patch of illness and we return to health, and that's there's that intrinsic message in there too.
Yeah, very good. How important do you think it is for a listener to appreciate that message?
That's a great question. The work hopefully exists if you never read the story.
As I said, that's how it occurred for me.
But hopefully you get to listen to it in a different way if you read the story as well.
Yeah.
I'm always, to go back to the genesis of any work that I have, I'll always have the genesis which allows me to break the blank page to start to write, which is always a tricky moment it's a tricky moment for me. It may or may not be tricky for any novelist or painter or any creative artist. But for me, the blank page can sometimes be tricky, and that's the way I get over that particular speed hump. And then it takes on a life of its own, this piece, and sometimes it's the initial impetus for it gets completely forgotten and the piece exists on its own terms.
Mm-hmm.
But in this instance, that didn't happen.
It's just one other thing I'd like to ask about that piece. Yeah. It's the title is Suspended.
Yep.
Any significance to that?
So it's two things. There's this, which is the this chord, which has both an A chord, but
yep.
It has the fourth in it, and traditionally a suspended chord with its resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And in this instance, I play both the major third and the suspended fourth,
mm-hmm.
the perfect fourth, simultaneously. Mm-hmm. So it's it's a reference to that particular chord, but also to the fact that in moments of duress, be it in the moment before you have an accident where adrenaline kicks in, time just slows. And the idea, placing myself into that with my own daughter, that the idea of what sickness, how time would just stop while there was illness or sickness with her, and how time would just stretch.
Yeah.
And so it's a moment. It's a moment in time, stretched or suspended.
Well. Yeah. Fantastic. But on the other hand, does it bother you if somebody completely misinterprets a work or gets value from it? That's something totally different, interpreted in a different way to the way you intend.
Not at all. I mean, there's a lovely... The joy of the abstraction of music is the fact that there are as many versions of what a piece means as there are listeners.
Mm.
Some people appreciate being led and some people hate being told a backstory or told what to feel or what to think during a piece of music. And so hopefully it can exist in this instance as either on its own terms or deep inside my conception of it. But no, once it's out there, I think it has its own ability to be interpreted. It's not a complex work by any means, and I think the interesting thing is something that I spend a lot of time thinking about is some of my least favourite works now are the ones that really know themselves, that where I'm certain about what I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
And some of my favourite works are the ones where I haven't quite been sure about what it means, but they work. But they work on some other, or there's enough things going on in them that there's some sort of an argument that I'm not quite sure what it is. That I've been in control, or I've been in control of a number of arguments that have been going along, but I haven't told the audience or any listener which one they should follow. And for both the performers performing it and an audience receiving it, they're the really interesting thing. So there is no right answer.
Mm-hmm.
And those are new thoughts for me in the past couple of years. I was always certain as a younger composer that I've got to be very sure about every moment, and because that's what I want to say. And actually the great joy in getting older is that is to provide a landscape in which you find your own journey through it, and trying to stay in control of enough of the things to know that there's a multitude of ways through it.
Great.
It's never they're perhaps that's not particularly articulate in saying that, but I'm interested in less sure answers, and it feels more rewarding in the long run.
Fantastic. Talking about landscape, as you did there, landscape and connection to place seems to be important for you in your work, and also you seem to have a strong connection with the Indigenous peoples of Australia. I'm curious about that, about how significant all of that is for you, and you know, how it informs your work.
Yeah, I'm a first generation Australian. My parents are both English. And since working with Black Swan Theatre in the 90s, there were lots of Indigenous performers in Black Swan. And so I was lucky enough to get introduced very early in my professional life to working with Indigenous actors and musicians. Professionally, that and personally for me, working with Indigenous performers is my request to belong in this country, really. The longer I've worked with them, the more I realise that we, as exponents of Western music, it feels quite a transplanted kind of a culture. And my work with Indigenous performers is trying to reconcile the song of this country, the sounds and the stories of the earth itself, with the music that started to arrive 200 odd years ago, and they're very interesting questions for me because they have no answer yet.
Mm.
But and I don't need everybody to ask the questions, and I don't need every Australian artist to work with Indigenous musicians, but I myself need to do that as a way of reconciling my own existence. I feel my own existence in this country. I feel intrinsically Australian, and yet I'm aware that my ur text is somewhere in the far north of Europe. Being a ginger beard, you know, I feel more connected to the Icelandic sagas than I do to Australian Indigenous stories, but that's because they're of an equivalent age. So the folk musics and the folk tales of Western European prehistory are deeply interesting to me because of the way they counterpoint Indigenous stories in this country. And I think we're incredibly lucky as contemporaries to have the contemporaries these days who are around and still hold those stories, because there's chances that those things could have disappeared. And so anything that I can do to help those stories reach a wider audience, yeah, is a pleasure to